Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Emergency and Critical Care Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Small Animal Medicine, Kit Sturgis. Thank you, Kit. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Ina. It's a great pleasure to be here today to talk to you about the bleeding patient, because I think it is a critical area and one in which we can really impact on our patients and make a real difference between those patients that might survive and those that may not. So I think it's important to realise that although there are common causes of spontaneous bleeding, there are a number of other potential causes that we need to consider. And when we are presented with a patient that might be bleeding, it's rapidly recognising that bleeding is occurring, localising the source, and if it's not a specific source, the mechanism that results in hemorrhaging, and then effectively stabilising the patient. And that's broadly the order in which we will go through the presentation today. So we're going to be focusing on the acutely bleeding patient, not really intraoperative bleeding, but certainly postoperative bleeding if that occurs, how you're going to best use your practice resources, and what you might want to send to external labs, when and what sort of blood and blood products you'll use, and maximising the value of your imaging. The other issue that we often encounter with the acutely unwell bleeding patient is that the outcome is uncertain, as we don't yet know what the diagnosis is, but in order to stabilise the patient for long enough to find out, we are going to have to spend quite a lot of the owner's money to get to that point, and that makes communication very important, to make sure the owner understands that you could end up transfusing the pet and they still may not survive the experience. So in the acutely unwell patients, in the critical care patients I see, then clotting defects are a major cause ultimately of death or morbidity. And so both hyper and hypocoagulability can certainly lead to these issues. I think we are more and more realizing too that fibrinolytic disease does occur in our veterinary patients, and the image below, although it is of a cat, illustrates a case I saw a little while back of a young dachshund who bled out following a dental. Now, the vets haven't done any major interventions with the dental. It was just a cleaning and I think one small tooth removed, but the patient just wouldn't stop bleeding. What happened was every time you gave blood or blood products, clotting would occur, and then the clots would fail because he had fibrinolytic disease. And so it wasn't the primary clot that was the problem, it was secondary clot stabilization that was failing. If we do have an issue with coagulation, then obviously early recognition is important, and exactly what part of the cascade of the clotting system is involved is also important to know what our best options for therapy are going to be. So the clotting system has a potential problem in that it wants to clot very rapidly and effectively when there is damage, but it doesn't want to clot in the system, otherwise that can cause as many problems as it solves. So there's this competing pull between procoagulant and anticoagulant factors in the bloodstream. And whilst most of us were taught in college about some nice cascade like a series of waterfalls, this really isn't how the clotting system is thought of now. It's thought of much more of a complex system of overlapping events that are occurring all at the same time, which broadly do involve the clotting factors, platelets, fibrinogen, fibrin, and the vascular wall, but not really in a one-by-one process. I think the other thing that's important to realise is that because failure to clot is such a life-threatening condition, there's a lot of redundancy in the system. So we have to have fairly significant disease before we'll even start to get spontaneous bleeding. And so in many instances, the platelet count will need to be less than 10,000 and the clotting factors will have to fall below 10% of the expected level. So the first little bit, I want to quickly review the clotting system so we're kind of all on the same page, and then talk about how we assess this system. So as I mentioned, it's a balance between the pro and anticoagulant factors in the system, in the vascular space. And the key issue in most clotting is the exposure of the vascular surface, vascular injury, and the initial adhesion of platelets to the subendothelium. And this is mediated by von Willebrand's factor, and we'll talk a little bit more about von Willebrand's factor later on when we talk about how we recognize and manage that disease. So this was probably the picture that you have from your lecturing, many of you, certainly the older members of the audience, where we have the intrinsic and extrinsic coagulation cascade that comes down into the final common pathway, leading to production of fibrin, which then starts to bind the platelets, stabilizing the clot. But this is perhaps a more recent understanding of the clotting system, where this tissue surface becomes very critical. And that does present us with a number of issues when it comes to understanding what's happening with the clotting system, because the one thing that we struggle to do in a laboratory test is recreate this tissue factor bearing cell surface to see how the clotting system progresses. So we have a variety of currently available ways of measuring clotting. Physical examination obviously will give us some idea if the clotting system is compromised. Blood smears and platelet counts are vitally important. The one thing that I wouldn't do and wouldn't rely on is whole blood clotting. So just putting blood in a tube and seeing whether it will be a plain tube and seeing whether it clots is not an accurate method in any way of assessing the clotting system, and can give you really quite false results and lead you down the incorrect pathway. Buccal mucosal bleeding time is a very useful in-house test, simple to do, relatively cheap, and gives you a global view of what's happened with the clotting system. And then clotting factors, fibrinogen, fibrin degradation products, D-dimers, individual factors. These are all readily available on sent blood samples. Things that we don't do a great deal of, even in referral practice, are some of the more complicated measurements, and this would include platelet function and tests, looking at how platelets aggregate, and viscoelastometry, either thromboelastography or thromboelastometry. So buccal mucosal bleeding time, some calculated reference intervals for dogs and cats. Unfortunately, if you look at different references, you will get very much different times for buccal mucosal bleeding time. In cats, as you can imagine, it's very, very difficult to do without sedating, although it does not appear that sedation with the drugs illustrated on the slide has significant effect on clotting. But the biggest issue when people have studied the buccal mucosal bleeding time is that there's a huge intra-observer variability. So who does the clotting test makes a really big difference to the answer you get. So I think it's something that I do use, and certainly is valuable to use in practice if you have a patient where you're worried about the tendency to bleed and you don't have access to a wide range of other tests. But it's really only going to demonstrate fairly gross issues associated with coagulation. And just one final point, if you are going to do buccal mucosal bleeding part time, it's really important that when you blot away the blood, you don't touch the point at which the mucosal injury has been created by the little knife in the simplex device. Otherwise, you will disturb the forming clot. You're probably most familiar with prothrombin and activated partial thrombopastin times, but these were really originally developed to look at how warfarin anticoagulation was working in human heart disease. And they were never really intended as a global overview of intrinsic and extrinsic clotting systems. However, they do have value, and certainly if times are prolonged, they do tend to suggest that a patient is at risk of bleeding. So here are some of the reference ranges, but they do vary quite a lot, particularly with APTT, where a number of the in-house tests will be talking about reference intervals in the 80 to 100 seconds rather than 12 to 25 seconds. Quoted reference ranges in cats are in fact similar or slightly longer to those in dogs. But the problem for many practices is that the analyzers are relatively expensive and they do not assess the quality of the clot. So sometimes it will give you an answer, but actually that clot quality is really poor, and in the in vivo situation it really wouldn't lead to effective clot formation. Accuracy can also be an issue. So there's a couple of graphs below of some of the handheld and in-house clotting machines that I've looked at, reference to external tests. And as we can see, these two really did not correlate in any meaningful way with external reference lab on a paired sample. That doesn't mean to say all of these in-house machines are not of any real value. So this is another machine that I'm looking at currently, and that starts to give us a fairly reasonable correlation with the external reference and suggests that you can rely on the numbers that it's giving you to give you a general idea about clotting. And again, I think it's really important that we don't become very, very number focused. In other words, if the top end of the reference range is 25, if the number comes out at 26, that's highly unlikely to be an animal that's going to bleed. We're talking about at least a 50% rise above the top end of the reference range before there's any real likelihood that a patient will bleed. And a number of studies, for example, looking at liver biopsy, have suggested that the measuring APTT and PT before doing the liver biopsy correlates relatively poorly with the risk the patient has of bleeding. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that conclusion. Certainly for those animals where I have had bleeding following liver biopsy, then they've usually had grossly elevated APTT or PT. So I think if you see those, then those are the cases that really one needs to be worried about. I'm sure you're familiar with von Willebrand's factor. This is a little factor which links platelets and the exposed tissue surfaces. And there are a variety of deficiencies that are reported. And the severity of the deficiency depends on what happens to the von Willebrand's multimers. So the most common is type 1, accounting for about 90% of cases, and these are the ones that you probably have seen in practice. Durban pinschers and other breeds are particularly at risk, and the severity of bleeding tends to be quite variable. So some animals can have type 1 von Willebrand's, and they're only really going to bleed it with very serious challenge to the clotting system. As the disease becomes more serious, different genetic mutations, these are animals that have few, if any, multimers, or the multimers they have are very small multimers to type 3, where they have virtually none and where bleeding can be a major disease problem. We know that these are all inherited. Type 2 and type 3 are clearly autosomal recessive. Type 1 disease is a bit variable, and it's not entirely clear whether this is truly recessive trait or whether this is a partial expression or variable dominance. But if you have a line of dogs where they have problems with von Willebrand's disease, then it is likely that other members of the related members may well have that disease too. If you do see a case where you're concerned that von Willebrand's disease may be an issue, then in-house, buccal mucosal bleeding time is pretty much going to be the only test that you will be able to do to show that there is a coagulopathy. Won't confirm von Willebrand's disease, but if that's what you suspect, it will support your diagnosis. Otherwise, you have to measure von Willebrand's antigen via an ELISA or a collagen binding assay. All of the known genetic mutations, five that have been identified, there are direct DNA tests that have been developed. And what we mean by direct DNA tests is it looks specifically for the mutation rather than some other gene sequence, which is co-located with the particular mutation and therefore generally is inherited along with the mutation. Those tests are slightly less reliable than these direct DNA tests. We can measure platelet function. I'm sure you've come across various texts where people talk about thrombocytopathies rather than thrombocytopenia. And these are cases where the platelet count appears normal, but platelet function is significantly inhibited. And perhaps the most common cause that we'll see is where platelets become coated by proteins, for example, in multiple myeloma. And the way this system works is it draws the platelets through a small hole. The platelets are activated by a variety of different factors, such as collagen, and the time and the rate at which that hole closes over as the platelets aggregate is measured. So it's a rough test of platelet function, certainly doesn't measure all of the ways in which platelets may form a clot. We also mentioned viscoelastometry, and this is a thromboelastometry machine, which is perhaps the less common of the two types seen in veterinary medicine. More common are the elastography or TEG machines. They're less expensive. It depends which one you use as to which one you like. But the great advantage of this technique, the viscohemostatic assays, is the fact that it gives you a much better idea both of the way the blood clot is forming, how strong the clot is, how long it lasts. So it's a pretty old method, and broadly blood is incubated in a little cup, and either the cup is rotated around a pin or the pin is rotated within the cup. And as the pin moves and the clot forms, then the impedance of movement is measured, and this gives you what's called the thrombogram, which gives you an idea as to whether this is a normal clot, it's forming at a normal time, at a normal rate, with a normal strength, and also a little bit of information about thrombolysis. So does the clot, once it's formed, hold together, or does it start to fall apart? But even here, we still don't have that tissue factor. We still don't really, it's difficult to assess the involvement of von Willebrand's factors in these cases. So here's a little cartoon explaining that about the rotating pin, and light is bounced off the pin as it rotates, and the force that's required as the pin is moved and how quickly it's moving is measured and then expressed as a thrombogram. So this is a thrombogram from thromboelastometry with the various different measurements that people make. And broadly looking at it, the critical things in the initial formation of a blood clot is the steepness with which the alpha angle, in other words, how quickly the clot forms, and how wide the clot is, the maximum clot firmness, because that gives you some information of as the quality of the clot, as it were. So here is an example of a thermogram. This is looking at both extern, which broadly looks at the extrinsic, intern, which looked at the intrinsic, and the fibtern, which looks at just the fibrin part of it, and gives you different shapes because the clotting is being activated by different factors. But these taken together give you a broader idea of how well the clotting is proceeding. So this was Sky, and you can see that Sky's got evidence of hemorrhaging into her, luckily, eye with no pigment, so we can easily see those hemorrhages in that eye. And she had a complete thrombocytopenia, so she wasn't forming the clot at all. So we only really have the fibrin part of the clot forming, as opposed to what we would expect, which is the clot below. And this is another dog, Poppy. She had some level of clot formation, but it was really quite pathetic relative to a normal dog. Her APTT and PT were interestingly normal, but she did have a real bleeding tendency, and this is where these thermograms have advantages over our standard tests of clotting. And she had a large cell granulomatous tumour in her abdomen that was causing paraneoplastic effect. So These machines are all lovely and whizzy, but we have to think about what we can do in-house. And I think one of the most important things that we can do in-house is a platelet count. And that means making a fresh, good quality smear, staining it, making sure your stain is of good quality, has been filtered regularly. And broadly on a high-powered magnification, so that's a 100 times objective, then one platelet per high-power field is equivalent to about 20,000 platelets per microliter, where the reference range is somewhere around 160,000 to 300,000 to 400,000 platelets per microliter. So if you see more than a couple of platelets per high power field, then it's highly unlikely that your patient is bleeding because of thrombocytopenia. and the platelet count may be low because of consumption of the platelets, because the animal is bleeding for other reasons and the platelets are being used to try and control that bleeding. We've also mentioned the buccal mucosal bleeding time as being the other good way of trying to assess hemostasis in the patients that we have in the clinic as an emergency. Assessing the secondary hemostasis is more complicated because these machines that measure the secondary hemostasis are less readily available. Activated clotting time assesses the intrinsic and common pathways, and if you have an ISTAT machine, then you can get ACT cartridges for that. So that may be a way of getting some level of ability to assess secondary hemostasis clotting factors without having to buy the more expensive machines that are more dedicated to measuring APTT and PT. Other measurements that can be made are really ones that we need to send out to external laboratories. So moving on now from how we make our measurements to how these cases present. So history and presentation, I think, is the critical thing that's going to set us off on the line of thinking, well, maybe this patient is a patient that's bleeding, as not all patients present bleeding from their eyes, as is a favourite phrase of one of the nurses in the practice at work. History and signalment is really very important. So we know that there are certain breeds that have congenital factor deficiencies or von Willebrand factor deficiencies, so those should, you should always be alerted to those things. So if we see a Doberman that's had some moderate trauma, such a road accident, and seems to be bleeding, then we have to consider whether partly the reason it's continuing to bleed is because it's got a factor deficiency. Other breeds we know are more at risk of immune-mediated thrombocytopenia. Some breeds we know are also at risk of other immune-mediated diseases. Some breeds, such as the German Shepherds, are at risk of hemangiosarcoma. Oriental cats are at risk of amyloidosis. So all these sort of factors can play into whether you feel that bleeding becomes more or less likely when presented with the patient. And another sort of critical part of the history is the likelihood of trauma. So has the patient been involved in road traffic accidents or fallen? But also, as I mentioned briefly about the von Willebrand factor, is that bleeding proportionate? So in other words, has it had minor abdominal trauma and then has an abdomen full of blood? That's not what we would expect, and may suggest that even possibly the reason that trauma happened because the dog crossed the road less quickly was because it was already unwell. I think it's very important to look at previous response to challenged clotting. So any animal I see that I have concerns about the clotting system, one of the first questions I'm going to ask the owner was there any problems at neutering if the animal obviously has been neutered? But normally that's sufficient challenge that if you have more subtle congenital or inherited clotting defects, then you are already going to have some information that actually they bled quite a lot after surgery. And I think it's really important as veterinary practitioners and veterinary professionals that if we do have a patient that does bleed more than we expect following procedure, we should note that in the record, not look at it and think, well, maybe it was a mistake I made, and I really don't want to write it down because I don't want anyone to know about it. This could be a really important part of history for the client to know about, because in some later stage it might save the animal's life. It is very hard to know for definite whether there's been exposure to toxins, particularly in cats that go out and roam and we're not sure quite where they go. But generally, some areas of the country, I used to work down in Essex near Malden, and we used to see a lot of snake bites because there were snakes along some of the seawalls. Are you in an area where there are acorns? What's the rat population, rat issues like? Are people putting a lot of coumarins down to try and control the problem with the rats? And equally, worming history is important. Has the patient, in terms of it being a dog rather than a cat, has that received a worming product that is likely to be efficacious in managing lung worm? When it comes to how these patients present, well, if they've got big, large numbers of petechiae or big ecchymoses, then that's usually pretty obvious that bleeding, a bleeding problem is going to be high on the list of concerns. perhaps less obvious is those animals that either present with local disease in a single organ, such as high femur or hematuria or epistaxis, because in the majority of cases, those probably are going to relate to organ-specific disease rather than the global coagulation defect. But we certainly do see cases where single organ involvement was the initial presenting sign, so the cat that presents with just bleeding in the urine, although lower urinary tract disease is more likely, we have to consider the possibility of a global coagulopathy. Third space bleeding is particularly challenging because there may be very little outward signs, and until, certainly in the abdomen, until there's been a very large amount of bleeding, you're not going to see things like abdominal swelling. And if it's in the chest, then you may see no signs other than the development of dyspnea as the animal's respiratory volume becomes compromised by the fact that lungs are being squashed by the bleeding. Similarly, gastrointestinal hemorrhage, sometimes the owner's very clear that there's a problem because the animal is vomiting blood, but melena may be not noticed, particularly if it's a cat and goes out and buries the feces. And equally, in the really acute bleeding into the gut, sometimes no bleeding has been seen. So as yet, all the bleeding is internally into the gut lumen and nothing has come out. So don't completely exclude the possibility of gastrointestinal hemorrhaging as a cause of presentation if there is no obvious sign of outward bleeding in terms of hematemesis or melena. If the bleeding is into the lungs or the thoracic cavity, then dyspnea may be a sign. And then pretty much any other organ system can be involved, and certainly with some of the lung wound cases I used to see before this was well recognized by the public and the profession, all sorts of presentations, lameness, mast lesions, pain, neurologic signs. So we had the dog presenting for MRI because it was showing real pain in the temporal area. And in fact, this dog had lungworm, was bleeding and happened to bleed under the muscles, temporal muscles, which were being torn off the skull. And not surprisingly, this was acutely painful for the patient, but ultimately, thankfully, not particularly serious. Other signs we may see will be retinal hemorrhages. Again, might be an expression of hypertension, but also maybe a representation of clotting defects. Unexpected epistaxis, again, generally indicates nasal disease, possibly indicates hypertension, but we'd also have to consider that as a potential presenting sign for a for a clotting defect. So when it comes to investigating these patients, I think we have to have a rough idea of which bit of the system we are most concerned about and how we are going to investigate that. And probably the most common cause most of us will see, particularly in primary care practice, is going to be immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, or at least thrombocytopenia associated with abnormal platelet numbers. And although IMTP is the most common cause of thrombocytopenia in terms of significant thrombocytopenia that is going to cause bleeding, we have to realize that this could be a primary immune-mediated disease or secondary to infection or neoplasia or even inflammation in some circumstances. Sometimes platelets are sequestrated, such as when there's splenic congestion, but this is rarely severe enough to cause a platelet count to go low enough that we'd be worried about that as being the cause of the animal's bleeding. If the animal is bleeding for other reasons, then we will get consumption of platelets. But in fact, even under the more severe causes of bleeding, platelet counts rarely drop below about 50,000. And many patients, if there's been any duration for their bleeding, will actually have high platelet counts. The one exception to this is disseminated intravascular coagulopathy, where there is generalized activation of the clotting system. And these dogs and cats can certainly have platelet counts that are very low in the range that we would normally see with immune-mediated disease. Rarely, we're going to see decreased production associated with bone marrow disease. We see that as both primary and secondary problem. But perhaps the most common cause of a low machine-reported platelet count is, in fact, artifact. So when we look at decreased bone marrow production, certain some of the infectious disease like Ehrlichia, could be a risk. And as we're all aware, seem to be increasing reports of tick-borne and insect-borne diseases in the UK. A number of drugs that are used, particularly chemotherapy agents and estrogens, can suppress the bone marrow. But in these cases, one tends to see pancytopenias. So if we're talking about drugs, myelopathies or marrow aplasia, then pancytopenia is going to be the most common presentation. But because platelets have relatively short half-lives, they are often going to show up as a low numbers along with the neutrophils before we see frank anemia because of the much longer half-life of red cells. And then we do see a population of immune-mediated disease where that immune-mediated destruction is directed at the megakaryocytes themselves in the bone marrow. So peripherally, you don't have loss, but the platelets are not being released from the bone marrow because of that immune-mediated process. As mentioned, many of the cases of immune-mediated thrombocytopenia are secondary. So we're talking about various infections, parasitic disease, DIC, neoplasia, drugs, toxins, and in some cases, post-vaccination, although the fall in platelet count after vaccination is generally very mild. In terms of definition of thrombocytopenia, when you come to do any reading, some texts have a very strict definition of thrombocytopenia, which is any platelet count less than 160,000. But we see many, many reasons for that. And in the vast majority of cases, these are not of any critical importance to the patient. So if you are presented with a bleeding patient and you're not sure whether the platelet count is 100 or 130,000 per microliter, that really is not that critical in terms of why the patient is bleeding, because neither of those numbers are likely to cause spontaneous bleeding. And unless you get down certainly less than 40,000 and usually less than 10,000, then it's going to be a very rare, counts over that number are very rarely going to be associated with spontaneous bleeding. In terms of those breeds, as mentioned earlier, we certainly see some breeds like the Cocker Spaniels and Poodles where we see more primary IMTP. In dogs, there's a tendency for them to be females and of middle age. But as mentioned, one of the most common causes of machine-reported thrombocytopenia is actually artifact, either because there are clots or because we've got macrothrombocytes. And particularly, as we know in cats, they seem to clot so easily. Even when you get a clean stick of a vein, often you'll still get a low platelet count because micro and clots have formed. One other thing I should mention with that slide is the fact that we know too that sight hounds tend to have relatively low platelet counts. So for many sight hounds, a platelet count of 120 or so would be quite normal for them. Rarely do they, so some of these dogs ever get much above 200,000. When we're looking at cause of thrombocytopenia, then for significant thrombocytopenia, it's really only going to be those dogs that have those low platelet counts. And so if we're looking for dogs that bleed out of the low platelet count, then immune-mediated thrombocytopenia is probably the most common cause. If we look for thrombocytopenia generally, then there are many other causes, particularly inflammatory disease and various other causes of unwellness, which just comes under the multifactorial unknown causes in this table. As mentioned before, confirming that platelet count, you really do need to make a fresh smear. So I think if you're going to be involved in any significant way in any sort of emergency medicine, then it's really critical that the practice has a microscope which has high power and you have some stains present in the practice, just difficult stains that are going to allow you to make a smear and then identify that there are no microclots or aggregates, and if there are no microclots or aggregates, then count the number of platelets per high power field as previously discussed. If you then are confident that the platelet count is significantly low and you are well below the 50,000 and perhaps more in the 10,000 area and the animal is still bleeding, then you really want to understand if it's primary or secondary disease. And also, if there is bleeding, where is it going? Is it going externally? going into a third space, we're going into the gastrointestinal tract. So imaging in these cases is likely to be the thing that's going to deliver us the most valuable information. So other causes where we might get secondary RMTP are neoplasia. So in these pictures here, we've got two dogs presenting with splenic masses, this one on ultrasound, this one visible on x-ray, and then typical cannonball metastases. So these can certainly lead to low platelet counts and potentially spontaneous bleeding. And certainly with the splenic masses, you can then be in a situation where you have multiple causes of bleeding. So you have bleeding because of their neoplasia, but also bleeding because their neoplasm has ruptured. DIC is a potential major issue, and certainly when you get patients bleeding like this little dog here, then this is a really critical case, and rapid and aggressive management is required in order to hopefully have a chance to diagnose the cause of the DIC and see whether you are then in a position to be able to resolve that while supporting the patient's clotting to make sure it doesn't hemorrhage to death. Thrombocytopathies are rare, perhaps the best we know are the ones associated with the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and uremias, but also the dysproteinemias like myelomas. So this was a little caribou terrier presented recently, and the main reason the owner noticed there was a problem was because there was bleeding in and around the eye, but when it was examined by the referring vets, they certainly noticed major areas of petechiae and ecchymosis, although interestingly, by the time arrived at referral, there was very little evidence of petechiation and a lot more evidence of ecchymosis. And what we do with these cases is we do outline the degree of ecchymosis and to see whether the patient is progressing or not following management intervention. And this was the hematology from this particular patient. Clotting times are normal and platelet numbers are extremely low at 5. Biochemistry was pretty unremarkable. The change in liver enzymes are fairly typical of any animal under marked metabolic stress. And imaging showed no real evidence of primary cause. The only thing that I was concerned about in this patient was the presence of this area within the bladder, possibility of a primary urinary tract infection being the cause, but in fact it's turned out to be negative on culture, and that probably just represents a blood clot in the bladder associated with general procoagulant hemorrhagic state that this patient was under. Obviously, there are other cases that don't go so well. So this is Archie, a lovely labradoodle who presented both with lethargy and appetence, but his mucous membranes were pale and he was very jaundiced, as well as having evidence of petechial hemorrhages in the buccal mucosal membrane. He had clear evidence of immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, and sadly, despite aggressive intervention, Archie didn't survive because Evans syndrome is a difficult disease to try and manage, particularly when the patient's presenting this level of unwellness. More recent case still, Zungu, a Labrador, who managed to get hold of coumarin. And interestingly, there was very little evidence that she had any form of hemorrhage into her mucosal membrane. She seemed to be bleeding almost exclusively into her chest. So we can see on the chest x-ray below that there is separation of the lung field from the vertebral column, and also general fluffiness within the lung field, suggesting intrapulmonary hemorrhage as well. And this case, she did have a lowish platelet count, but still 117,000, so certainly not low enough of itself to be causing bleeding. Snake bites, common in some areas of the world, particularly Australia. A little bit of work has been done that suggests that actually cats seem more resistant to snake bites than dogs, which is interesting, as they have a generally a much lower body weight, so the amount of poison you think would be greater, whereas dogs following snake bites are much more likely to have prolonged clotting times, and some of them will require intervention. This was a case where we had quite obvious petechial hemorrhaging ecchymosis within the buccal mucosal membrane of a dog with a known snake bite, and that did require a plasma transfusion to control the tendency for this patient to clot, as it seems to be the clotting factors which are most critical in these snake bite cases. But we do see other causes of bleeding, so obviously ruptured splenic masses, as in the top right-hand corner, and then this was a young Siamese cat presented with weakness, and this is his x-ray, and this is the ultrasound which showed a granular fluid within the abdomen, typical of active bleeding, and this was a case of amyloidosis. But other causes, particularly angiostrongylus, we just need to continue to consider. Although, in my experience just at the moment, it almost seems to have gone the other way, that any case that's bleeding is lungworm, and sometimes time is lost in trying to worm the patient, worm the dog, when in fact there are other reasons for the bleeding, and that maybe if the worming history for the patient is good, then as far as we're aware, so far in the UK, there's no obvious resistance to the angiostrongylus to the products that will have been effective. So I think if worming history is accurate, it's important to move on and look for other potential causes of the hemorrhaging. One sort of specific area of interest is bleeding in greyhounds. So these greyhounds where you have gone through surgery and surgery seems to have gone well, no obvious bleeding has occurred, and then within 1 or 2 days you suddenly get evidence of bleeding around the site of surgery. And these really seem to be because of certain lines of greyhounds have a tendency to fibrinolysis, so that primary clot forms but never stabilizes. So initially when you're in the patient, everything seems fine, but afterwards when the clot needs to strengthen and needs to organize, this fails and bleeding recurs. And tranexamic acid is a treatment that is available for managing a tendency to fibrinolysis, and these are some of the dose rates people have suggested managing greyhounds with a tendency for this condition. I think if you suspect bleeding but there is no obvious source, and you've inspected carefully for petechiation ecchymosis, and just remember that there may not be that particularly large amount of petechiation, and you need to inspect all of the mucosal surfaces, so don't forget the prepuce and the vaginal mucosa. Those that do seem to bleed with the skin seem particularly to bleed in the ventral areas, in the axilla and the inguinal areas. So maybe if it's a very heavy coated dog, you have to consider clipping the dog up in order to be able to be sure that there's not bleeding there. Urinalysis can be important in case there's bleeding into the urine. And this is a case following a road accident where it was evidently anemic, and there was quite marked hemorrhage into the substance of the bladder. And when the cat eventually did urinate, it was urinating what looked like almost pure blood. And then we have to think about the third spaces, so imaging is going to be the K. Also, potentially, if we have severe acute GI tract bleeding, then what you're going to see is fluid-filled loops of bowel, even though you may not yet see evidence of outward bleeding from the gastrointestinal tract. One of the techniques that has to be developed are these fast scans of the abdomen, and they're supposed to be originally designed to look for trauma, but they're very good for looking at evidence of abdominal bleeding using the four different positions. And generally, if you've got evidence of blood or evidence of fluid that is likely to be blood on at least three of the areas that you scan, then that hemorrhage is likely to be significant in that patient and needs to be actively. Just a brief word about cats. This is really here to just illustrate that bleeding in cats is relatively uncommon and is much more likely for the vet or the nurse to be bleeding than the cat. But we do see bleeding issues in cats, and we need to be aware of those, and we need to be looking for them. Again, falsely low thrombocyte counts are quite common in cats because of the tendency for them to have sticky platelets. This is really just to mention that things like D-dimers appear to be relatively poor as predictors of bleeding in cats, or predictors at least of DIC. We do see other associations, so certainly FIP would be one of the conditions where we will see DIC in cats. Pancreatitis will be another case, and here's an illustration of a cat with a feline pancreatic lipase of 51 and evidence of hemorrhaging into the abdomen. Cats also seem a little bit more likely to bleed associated with liver disease, and the studies that have been published would suggest that any cats with a markedly elevated outcross over 500 are at risk of bleeding. So this would be something I might pay attention to if I was going to do a liver biopsy in a cat, but if their outcross was significantly elevated, then that may make me worry about the risk of hemorrhaging, be careful about the technique I've chosen, so more likely to do an open technique where you can control hemorrhaging than something like a needle core biopsy. But perhaps more than anything, we do associate cats with hypercoagulability, and although this is not a talk about hypercoagulability, it does illustrate the issues associated with the fact that cats are hypercoagulable. And the video that you should be now seeing just shows typical spontaneous echogenic contrast or smoke in the left atrium of a cat that's at particular risk of developing an embolus, so the other side of the clotting system has gone wrong. And an ultrasound of thromboembolus in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy cases sitting just at the trifurcation of the aorta, just down here. So in the final sort of 10 minutes, so I just quickly wanted to talk about how we're going to manage the patient. So we've made our diagnoses, and now we're looking at managing these patients. And really the management depends on where we feel the problem is lying, whether it's in primary or secondary hemostasis, whether it's platelets, whether it's clotting factors. So if there's an obvious bleeding point, then we need to be controlling it. If there's an obvious clotting problem, then we need to be deciding which clotting problem the patient has and how we're going to manage that. This is where blood and blood products can become critical to the survival of a patient. But just a few things to remember, that although whole blood is great, and generally if I have a patient that's bleeding, I'm not going to transfuse them unless their PCB is getting moderately low, in the hope that if it's at least reasonable, then my interventions will be sufficiently swift that the PCB won't fall low enough to require transfusion. The advantage of whole blood is it replaces everything, so not just red cells, but also clotting factors and platelets. However, in thrombocytopenia patients, because of the immune-mediated destruction, those transfused platelets may last a very short period of time. So again, it's not really going to be an effective treatment for an animal with thrombocytopenia that's bleeding for more than those patients where the bleed has become got to the point where it's acute and life-threatening. In dogs, if we're just really looking to try and sort out the anemia that's resulted from the bleeding, then packed red cells are often a much easier and preferable route to go. If the bleeding is due to clotting defects, then we need to be thinking about plasma transfusions. And I really strongly believe that any practice of any reasonable size should really have at least one unit of fresh frozen plasma in the freezer, because when you need it, you kind of need it now. But don't think that plasma is the only thing that we really need to do in these cases. Don't forget that vitamin K is an important part of the therapy. So just quickly illustrating the difference between fresh frozen plasma and frozen plasma. So fresh frozen plasma contains the labile clotting factors, and these can be really quite important as they're often the ones that are relatively low, although it's often factor 7 that's lowest in, for example, coumarin poisoning, and therefore frozen plasma will have a valuable effect in these cases. And this is a little outline of some of the best evidence that we currently have on whether we should be using plasma, and at the top of the list, as you can see, is really going to be coagulopathies associated with rodenticide poisoning or angiostrongylus. We've got good evidence with those, good evidence with von Willebrand's disease that clotting factors can be replaced and have a very positive effect on the patient. If you have a patient which is thrombocytopenic, you haven't yet managed to get enough evidence to know whether it's primary or secondary, but the patient is bleeding, then there's nothing wrong with starting glucocorticoid therapy, even if subsequently it turns out that there was a secondary cause. 2 or 3 days, 4 days even, of glucocorticoid therapy is not going to significantly alter the outcome for those patients that have secondary thrombocytopenia. And in those patients which have primary disease, early intervention with glucocorticoids can have a really profound benefit and really profound effect on outcome. If you do subsequently find out it's secondary immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, then even with high-dose steroids, you can just stop those steroids abruptly after 4 or 5 days. You do not need to tail them off. So if you find out it's actually got infection, then that's fine. It really will not have significantly compromised the patient. So take home message from this is you need to treat and you need to treat early. Some people will use vincristine when platelet count is really low, and exactly how the vincristine is working, whether it's causing the megakaryocytes to shed platelets or whether it's loading the platelets with toxic vincristine and killing off the phagocytic macrophages is not entirely clear. And then some people use intravenous human immunoglobulin, and there's a little bit of information on this slide, dose rates that we might use. Currently, the jury is out, it's expensive, supplies are relatively limited, and benefit is there, but other forms of management are often as effective. When you think you have a von Willebrand's disease case, then certainly it's worth considering how you're going to treat those. Cryoprecipitate is better than fresh frozen plasma. This is where donation has been undergone a freeze precipitation process, and this concentrates the von Willebrand's factor. So you're able to get away with a much lower volume than you would do if you're using fresh frozen plasma. But if you do have a suspected von Willebrand's case and you follow my advice and you have that unit of plasma in the freezer, fresh frozen plasma in the freezer, then use it because it certainly will have a valuable effect. At present, we don't have any recombinant von Willebrand's factor for use in dogs. In those cases where you suspect or know that there's a von Willebrand's factor issue and you are going to have to challenge the clotting system, then it's important to be prepared. So if you are going to do surgery, then you have to be particularly thorough with controlling local bleeding, and in those circumstances, often diathermy becomes necessary. Interestingly, desmopressin acetate, normally a drug that we would associate with management of diabetes insipidus, does cause a dose-dependent increase in factor VIII and the release of von Willebrand's factor. And we can use it at the dose rate here, 1 microgram subcutaneously, 30 minutes prior to surgery. It's only going to work in type 1 von Willebrand's disease patients, type 2 and type 3. The response is just not going to be enough. But again, if you are in a situation where you know or suspect that you have a patient with von Willebrand's, having DDAVP ready and available can be very important and life-saving. So just to finish up, and I'm sorry it's been a little bit of a gallop through this last bit, I think any patient that comes in bleeding, comes in as an emergency, we have to consider bleeding as a potential cause, particularly those that are collapsed, particularly those that are pale. But just remember that a pale patient doesn't necessarily mean a patient that's got low red cell count and may be bleeding. We see pale patients because they're hypovolemic, pale patients because they've got cardiovascular disease. In cats particularly, we see pale patients because of high sympathetic tone. The first point is taking a good history and carefully examining the patient. And again, this illustration we've seen earlier in the course of the presentation, but this was a little dog, Lola, that came in with thrombocytopenia. And she really only had one or two tiny little petechiae in her buccal mucosa, although clearly she had the much larger ecchymotic type hemorrhages in her ventrum. But unless you're going to look at her carefully, it would be easy to miss a most small number of petechiae. In-house, you're going to need to learn to do blood smears and look for platelets. That means decent microscope. That means being able to make a good blood smear and stain it in-house. Buccal mucosal bleeding times, if you don't have access to a machine that will measure APTT and PT, is a very valuable test. It is a good and probably the only really good global assessment of bleeding. The problem that we have with it as a test is the large level of interoperator variation, so repeatability tends to be poor. So the number you get may well depend a lot on who did the test. And finally, when you have this patient in front of you that is bleeding and you're really focused on going ahead and trying to manage it, just think about what tests you might need to be doing to confirm your diagnosis. And there's nothing more frustrating than having a patient where you didn't get the diagnosis you were expecting, and then you find that the results of the samples you now need to take will be affected by the treatment you've already given. So if you have a patient that you think is bleeding or you know is bleeding, then taking some citrate-free plasma, that's good for most tests that you're going to want, clotting factors in particular, ABTT, PT, D-dimers, all of those can be done on citrate-free plasma. Ideally, separate the plasma from the citrate-free red cells, and because that is more stable. And obviously, making a fresh blood smear is essential. So if you're not confident in what you saw in practice, then you can always send a sample off to an external lab for their opinion. And then when it comes to treatments, we need blood products available, and we need to think about what the specific disease is, whether in fact something like DBAVP is necessary, whether in fact steroids are an appropriate course of treatment, or whether this patient needs surgery because we've got a bleeding major organ. Just wanted to mention under the acknowledgements that the data that I present on the coagulation machines, I was provided some funding by loan of the machines and free reagents. I'd like to thank CPD Solutions for allowing me to give this webinar, an area that I really am fascinated in, that these patients who are not clotting properly. I'd like to thank the referring vets because they send me all these great cases, and you for listening. So just in conclusion, I think we have a few minutes to answer any questions. So if you'd just like to type any questions that you may have into the Q&A box, then I'll do my best to answer them. So there's a couple of questions that have come in. One is about the costs of machines that will measure APTT and PT in practice. And those generally are in the region of £2,000 to £3,000. So relatively expensive unless you're going to be doing a reasonable number of clotting assays. And that certainly is one of the frustrations, I think, that we see. And then another question about just clarifying the use of steroids in immune-mediated thrombocytopenia. And that's really that you can use glucocorticoids, either dexamethasone if the animal is really not going to take oral medication, or prednisolone if they will take oral medication. And it doesn't matter if you don't yet know the diagnosis. The critical thing is you've taken the relevant samples to make the diagnosis, and you're waiting for the laboratory results to come back. But in the immediate term, the patient is actively bleeding, and you need to be trying to support that patient. Because transfused platelets last such a short period of time, that isn't a viable option. And unfortunately, in our pets, we don't have access to fresh frozen, to platelet-rich plasma. So that isn't an option for us. So giving steroids is perfectly acceptable. And what you need to do then is start your high-dose steroids, 2 milligram per kilogram equivalent of prednisolone. And if 2 or 3 days later you get your lab test back and say, well, clearly it's a different disease, it's not a primary disease, it's a secondary disease, then it really should not have significantly compromised the patient. You can acutely stop the steroids because as yet the adrenal gland has not been suppressed enough that it can't then take over the normal background function. So have a few more moments if there are any more questions. Otherwise, I'd like to thank you again for listening. Hope you've got some valuable information out of this webinar.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kit for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.